Welcome to Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. On this podcast, we'll be discussing nonviolent readings of Latter-day Saint Scripture. I'm Dan, and I'm joined by my wife and co-host, Marianne.
The Latter-day Peace Studies Project is born out of a desire to proclaim peace by providing an opportunity to approach religion, Scripture, and relationships with God in a peaceful way. As we develop peace within ourselves first, we can reflect peace into the world around us. The Latter-day Peace Studies Presents Come Follow Me podcast seeks to assist listeners in their approach to Scripture by providing nonviolent interpretation. Our hope is that we can integrate the teachings of the Scriptures into our efforts to find peace within ourselves and proclaim peace in the world.
Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies Presents Come Follow Me. This week we are in the war chapters. We've got this week and next week through the end of Alma. This week we're in Alma 43 through 52. Now if you want like real in-depth verse by verse, there are other podcasts that I think might do these chapters a bit better than we do. When talking about these chapters, Marianne and I were just saying, you know, this is going to be a lot of skimming. There's a handful of themes that we definitely want to dwell on, but unlike, you know, other weeks where I've been really tempted to do verse by verse because there's so much good, like there's so much narrative in these that it's really hard to, it would make no sense for us to do that. And I think one thing though is as you're reading, like sometimes paying attention to the years is really helpful. I think, Marianne, did you say that? That's right. This time, this year as I've studied, I've noticed, hey, these years overlap a lot.
Yeah, we don't get a direct linear presentation of what happened before something else. We get something here in the 18th year, and then we get something that happens in the 22nd year, and then they go back to the 18th year again. And then they talk, you know, they jump back and forth. Mormon does a little bit. Yeah, it hops around a little bit. And if you're not paying close attention, it would seem to just go from point A to B to C to D.
One of the big themes that's going to come out in all the war chapters is that the real problem for the Nephites is not the Lamanites. It is the Nephites. Both internally and externally, we see various groups of splintered Nephites that are going to cause so many problems for the Nephites, both domestically and who are out fighting in the wars. That theme of the apostate Nephites just really keeps coming up. First, we've got Zarahemla.
So Zarahemla is part of the Zoramites. So they go over and join the Lamanites and stir them up and bring them against the Nephites.
We do get sort of these first intimations of what will become the title of liberty when it talks about, you know, supporting lands and houses and wives and that sort of thing. I had to pull up David O. McKay. He had a quotation on the Christian attitude toward war. He said, "War is basically selfish. Its roots feed in the soil of envy, hatred, desire for domination. Its fruit, therefore, is always bitter. War impels you to hate your enemies. The Prince of Peace says, love your enemies. War says, curse them that curse you. The Prince of Peace says, pray for them that curse you. War says, injure and kill them that hate you. The risen Lord says, do good to them that hate you." So just one of those things to keep in mind as we ponder on the war chapters and their purpose, their function in this all. You know, I think Mormon keeps them for a lot of reasons. One, because he really admires Moroni, but also there is stuff to be grabbed here.
I think that the war chapters and the first part of Helaman that talks so much about political intrigue and such is in preparation for when Christ comes. And I think it's a good contrast to the way that Christ sets up his kingdom when he comes among the Nephites. Well, the Nephites and Lamanites, let's be clear about that. So I think that Mormon mentions so many of the details in these wars between the Nephites and the Lamanites, not only because he is personally interested in that. I do think that, you know, maybe a different person compiling the records might have given a different take, or maybe not included as many details. But I do still believe that these details are useful and important for us, and we ignore them at our peril. One of the reasons that I think that they're important is to detail just how destructive war is, even when it is justified. Mm-hmm. And how the Nephites are defending their homeland from people who are trying to take them over. They are just in their cause, and even so, it causes incredible destruction and heartache. And just as you read that quote from President McKay, that war can never bring what peace brings. It is the antithesis, and so it can only bring suffering. So perhaps Mormon included so many of these details to show us that even when a war is waged with, I mean, the very best commander you could ever imagine, both in strategy and in character, just unassailable goodness, even so, it can't save their people. The people still fall into pride, and this is not, they don't repent after this war and stay that way until Jesus comes. They continue to go through the cycles. And so to me, these war chapters are illustrating, are Mormon illustrating the futility of war.
Yeah, I think you have to, if you're going to read these and you're going to take these as your guide to everything good, is that fair? I think what you have to then face is that if the Nephites were perfectly justified in everything that they did for war, and everything that they did was just to preserve their society, well, if you fast forward just a few years, what do we have? We have the Gadianton robbers come in, infiltrating the entire government.
All the way back to the reign of the judges, beginning of the reign of the judges, under King Mosiah, or, you know, following King Mosiah II, that the Nephites' failure to deal with dissensions among them is what keeps leading to destructive forces winning in their society. From Nehor to the Amlicites to Ammonihah to Korihor to the Zoramites, all of these dissenting groups, their inability to integrate them and try to keep them as their brethren, even if they're not, even if they don't accept Christ or accept the gospel or want to be a part of the church or any of that, their inability to be in relationship with them on a societal level, again, not as an individual, as individuals, but on kind of a societal level, they can't seem to coexist with these dissenters. I just can't help but see that pattern coming up over and over again here, that really being in a compassionate way. I don't know how I would have fared in that society either. Like, it does really seem like a lot of these groups of dissenters, they weren't minor points of difference, right? Like, they were, right. It was a big deal. And many of them did have the thirst for power and pride and desire for their own aggrandizement rooted in those things. And so it's hard to make peace with someone who just wants war. Mm-hmm. I get that. But the part of me that is hopeful, that believes in the message of the Sermon on the Mount, wants to believe that there could have been a way.
Yeah. I've gone back and forth because part of me says, you know, well, yeah, I hope that there is a better way. Maybe there was a better way for these to be resolved. But we also, I mean, this is also before Christ comes, right? Before mm-hmm. the scapegoat mechanism is revealed. So there is plenty of scapegoating that goes on in these chapters. We'll see that even from Moroni. He is going to sort of set up this competition with this competing desires. They both want the same thing repeatedly with some of these Lamanite generals who are, in any case, former Nephites.
Yeah.
But there's also, I think Moroni also adeptly uses sort of that Girardian mimetic desire as part of establishing the title of liberty. It's something that he can point others towards, that they can develop that framework of they both want these things. If we can focus on the right desires, maybe we can change people. It's probably too early to get quite into that, but I don't know. Maybe not. We've got to go over the
thematic approach than a chronological one this time.
I mean, the story of the conflict with Zarahemla, this is sort of the first teaser war. I mean, we've had wars going on throughout all of Alma, but it's not until Moroni comes in that we really call them like the war chapters. So this encounter with Zarahemla, this is definitely establishing Moroni's character, his willingness to end the conflict at the first sign of the enemy yielding. I have to touch on some verses, but verse 46 and 47 is this area where we get these, the Lord had said, inasmuch as you're not guilty of the first or second offense, you'll not suffer yourselves to be slain. And the Lord has said, you shall defend your families even unto bloodshed. We don't have a reference for these. Presumably this is somewhere in the lost 116 pages. But it's interesting to think about this and reflect on it, especially in comparison to, say, the Ammonites or the anti-Nephi Lehites. And how does that jive with them? And I don't think I don't think we really get the reconciliation of those ideas until next week in the letter that comes back from, who's the chief judge?
Bahorin.
Until we get the letter back from Bahorin. And so this tension of the example that we've just been given of the Ammonites and then the Nephite wars, I feel it's a tension. And they have to constantly say, like, here's the reason we're justified. Here's the reason we're justified. We're only fighting because of this. Like, we're only, and it's almost like, okay, I get it, right?
Yeah, protesting too much.
Yeah, and you know, it's a constant reminder because, I mean, it's pretty obvious. Moroni doesn't want to fight these wars. There's maybe one or two parts where he seems like a little bit, he really wants to fight, but I think he really does believe in the cause.
He most certainly does. And it speaks several times of Moroni being angered by the actions both of Amalickiah and of Zerahemna and the other kingmen in his country who are seeking to overthrow their liberty. He is a man who seems to have access to his anger, but that sort of righteous anger impels him toward action. When he sees something, anger as an emotion is usually a flag that tells us that we're recognizing something's not right. We see injustice or we see something that is wrong, and anger is the natural reaction to that. Now, what we do with that anger, that can be morally right or wrong actions, but feeling anger in itself is not a morally right or wrong action. Feeling that emotion, but what you do with it matters. And for Moroni, this anger impels him to act, to encourage his fellow man to be a standard, to raise a standard for what they should be fighting for and the things that are right. And if they're, you know, the kingmen are acting like this and they should be acting like this, he's seeing what's wrong with the world and trying to right it. Whereas the anger of someone like Amalickiah is stirred up by his own pride. It says several times that he swore in his wrath or that he was wroth. And that comes from like our ego being injured and us reacting in pride. And so I think that's a different emotion than like a righteous anger.
Well, and like Zerahemna, we get in Zerahemna that he did stir up the remainder of the soldiers to anger. Right. So what's he doing with his anger? He's not using it to defend something. He's using it to essentially force people to go fight. Moroni, his anger impels him to change and find solutions.
Yeah.
Whereas all of these apostate Nephites, their anger leads them to go find Lamanites to kill Nephites.
Yeah.
They've only got one direction. Whereas we see Moroni does a lot of different things with his anger.
Yeah, he seems to direct it in more productive veins.
Yeah.
Do we want to do some contrast here between the character development of Moroni versus the character of Amalickiah? You ready for that?
Yeah, I think so.
Because I do think it's pretty clear that these two are being set up in contrast to each other as foils for each other.
Yes, I think in a very similar way to King Benjamin and King Noah.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things about Moroni, so the Mormon talks a lot about Moroni's character. And if we weren't sure how much he really likes Moroni, he names his own son after him. So that's how important this man's example is to the prophet Mormon. Moroni, at the end of chapter 43, when he sees the Lamanites' terror, he commanded his men that they should stop shedding their blood. As soon as they surrender or look like they don't want to fight anymore, he commands his men to stop killing them and offers them the opportunity to make a covenant of peace. He does require that covenant of peace, and that is a type of peacemaking, not just peacekeeping, ensuring that there will be peace for the future. He does not allow his soldiers to attack either defenseless people or people who clearly don't want to fight anymore. Any opportunity that there is to not fight, Moroni will take that. And I think that we see throughout human history how incredibly rare that is in the character of a person, that Moroni is truly one in a million character-wise, that he can be both a commander of armies and not have that thirst for bloodshed, not delight in the slaying of his enemies. And Mormon tells us later that he delights in the freedom of his people. And so he never develops a taste for conquering his enemy. It's not to validate his pride. His pride doesn't factor into it. He wants to protect the people around him and ensure their freedom. And that is, from a human standpoint, the very best and most noble aspirations that we could have as humans, right? We can all hope to be so noble-hearted.
I've been really impressed with this read-through as I've been sort of looking at Moroni and the depth of his emotion, because not only do we have, I mean, all of the things that Mormon says, you know, if all men were like Moroni, then gates of hell should be shaken. But we get times where he is, we've already talked about him being angry. We get times where he is sad, where he's sorrowful, where he's losing faith, not faith in God, but faith in other people. He's got quite the range. I mean, he's just such a dynamic character. I think it's impossible not to just see him as, I mean, almost mythological in terms of like archetypal in many ways.
It definitely says that he was a man like unto Ammon, the son of Mosiah, yea, and even also the other sons of Mosiah, and Alma and his sons, for they were all men of God. So he was a man of God, but he still would search out Alma and then later Helaman for revelation and guidance as far as it came to spiritual matters. He did not claim to have either priesthood authority or a prophetic role in his community, but he sought out the counsel of the prophet.
I'm kind of struck by when we get this comparison of Captain Moroni to Ammon, which seems like kind of a random comparison. But one of the things that I noticed, and I talked about this with you earlier this week, but not only is Captain Moroni a foil of Amalickiah, Ammon is an inversion of Amalickiah, because Ammon and Amalickiah both flee to the Lamanites. They flee, they're accepted by a king, they're sent to essentially round up a scattered flock. They both kill the leader, in one case, the one who's scattering the flock, one who is sort of the leader of the scattered flock, and they return to the king. And so then we have these contrasting scenes of one where the king falls into this coma-like state, and one where the king is killed. In one case, the servants gather around him, and the other case, the servants approach him. Instead of Abish raising the fallen queen, the servants, as they're raised by the king, then they stab him through the heart instead of him being pierced by the spirit. Then the servants flee instead of, you know, having noised abroad the king's death. The servants are now scapegoated. And then Amalickiah, what does he do? He goes into the queen and marries her, which completes the loop, because when Ammon first arrived, he rejected the hand of a Lamanite princess. And where do the servants of the Lamanite king go? They go to the people of Ammon.
Yeah, they do.
So there's this, I mean, if you kind of map it out mentally, there's this wild loop between Ammon and Amalickiah that I think I'm justified in saying that that's the case. And then we have it come up again, not this week, but next week, because when Moroni is looking for a Lamanite among his group, he finds a Lamanite who's one of the servants who ran away from this original King Laman.
That's a nice little detail that we get there.
It's such a, I mean, just these intertwining, you know, interweaving threads. And again, we know that in Mosiah, we get these sort of multiple groups of people in different areas and different things happening at different times. That happens during these war chapters, but it's a lot more hidden. Anyways, that was something that came to me this week. I'm not sure that I've ever seen anyone compare Ammon and Amalickiah this way. None of the commentaries that I read showed it up. I'm sure someone must have, but I don't know. That struck me.
Yeah, that is a really interesting how many parallels there are in their stories. Or, you know, divergent paths, even echoes. So Amalickiah is this man who wants, he's a Nephite and he wants to become king. And he encourages a group among the Nephites to petition to change the law so that they can have a king, so that he can be the king. And he seems to be very good at flattery, and he flatters a lot of these powerful people to influence in this direction to try to get them to change the laws. Well, the majority voice of the people comes and says, no, we want our law to remain how it is. We don't want a king. And that causes a problem because Amalickiah is not willing to accept that. He and his followers, who they call kingmen because they want to have a king, they go over into the Lamanites. Well, they fight Moroni a bit, and that's the impetus for Moroni creating the title of Liberty. Mm-hmm. It's not in contrast, or it's not against what the Lamanites are doing to them. It's actually against the dissensions in their own land and the people who want to have a king to rule over them. I thought it was really interesting that those people who were desirous that Amalickiah should be their king, they were wroth, and they were the greater part of them, the lower judges of the land, and they were seeking for power. And they had been led by the flatteries of Amalickiah, that if they would support him and establish him to be their king, that he would make them rulers over the people. And just how often we see this kind of pattern enacted in the world throughout history. I think sometimes, I mean, we see this happen among the Nephites, but I kind of wonder sometimes as I was reading through these chapters, we like to think of ourselves as the Nephites. When we're reading this, I don't know, I tend to put myself in the place of the Nephites because we're hearing the story usually from the Nephites' perspective. So you're going to naturally put yourself in their society and their experience. But I wonder sometimes if our society is a little bit more like the Lamanite society. Hmm. The Lamanites allow other people to come in and stir them up. They welcome dissenters in a way that is not healthy for them. They get outside people who don't have a vested interest in their culture and history and, you know, who don't love and care about them, trying to use them for their own political purposes. How often are the Lamanites used by dissenting Nephites? They pay the price with their lives often. Anyway, I was just thinking about sometimes how easily sometimes they are stirred up to anger and allow these persuasions and arguments to get them riled up about something that doesn't affect them, that isn't really any of their business or doesn't affect their daily lives. Or we don't know exactly the kinds of things that the Amlicites or the Zoramites or the Kingmen, they don't tell us a lot of the arguments that they use with the Lamanites to stir them up. Mm-hmm. We can guess at some of them, but they don't say a lot of those persuasions or arguments that they give, but they seem to often work. Once in a while, it takes the people longer. So there's a good portion of the people among these Lamanites here who Amalickiah comes over to stir them up. And he wins the king to his side and a portion of the people, but a good portion of the army is like, no, we really don't want to go to war again. And we're going to form ourselves into our own group to say, we don't want to do what the king, the more part of them, it says, would not obey the commandments of the king. So we can see some resistance among the Lamanites to dissenters trying to beat the war drum, trying to draw them into more wars that have nothing to do with them.
I have hope that we are more like the Lamanites because the Lamanites are the ones who are always ready to change. They are the ones who are constantly, you know, being converted, whereas the Nephites, you know, it takes all sorts of bearing down and preaching and keeping the church in order. I think we get the idea of the church being regulated before and after these Amalickiah wars a couple times. Mm-hmm. Helaman has to go and like reestablish the church because they just don't get it. But he doesn't have to do that among the Ammonites. In fact, Lamanites who defect go to the people of Ammon and they're all converted.
Yeah. Yeah. The people of Ammon seem to be the place where anyone can go and be accepted. And then what's the word you might use? I don't mean neutralized, but I just mean like going and living in that Zion-like society changes everyone who goes in. I think once I called them the washing machine of the Book of Mormon, of like this people, their goodness is so proactive and so powerful that anyone who experiences it joins them.
Yeah. Which, I mean, compare that to the way that the Nephites wage war. And while they are protecting themselves, they're not causing change. Mm-hmm. So this is, we see two essential strategies. You know, I mean, part of it, maybe it is necessary for the preservation of Nephite society that they have to fight some of these defensive wars. But again, you ask yourself, well, could there have been a better way? We saw the success of the Sons of Mosiah. What if they had committed, an even larger missionary force?
Well, and it says in verses So we're in chapter 48, verses 23 through 25. Okay, so 23 through 25, kind of right in there. They were sorry to take up arms against the Lamanites because they did not delight in the shedding of blood. And this was not all. They were sorry to be the means of sending so many of their brethren out of this world into an eternal world unprepared to meet their God. So they have this godly sorrow. They're not delighting in the bloodshed, which is an important intent in the state of our hearts. Nevertheless, they could not suffer to lay down their lives that their wives and their children should be massacred by the barbarous cruelty of those who were once their brethren, yea, and had dissented from their church and had left them and had gone to destroy them by joining the Lamanites. Yea, they could not bear that their brethren should rejoice over the blood of the Nephites so long as there were any who should keep the commandments of God. For the promise of the Lord was, if they should keep his commandments, they should prosper in the land. And my question is, at the end of that, that if they're keeping the commandments, if they truly trust the promise of the Lord, could they have trusted him to protect them? Couldn't they have trusted in his arm instead of the arm of flesh? They were exercising faith. And this is why I think it's important to bring in this discussion of justification versus sanctification. The war that the Nephites are waging here is justified. They are fighting for a good cause. They are not fighting for political power or expansion of their borders or riches or their own pride. They are protecting their families. And that is good. But could there be something better? The justification, I imagine, of is the Lord saying, that is good and that is right. But when you're ready, I have something better for you. I think we see the people of Ammon accepting that. And then the people in 4th Nephi, when Christ comes, also accepting that. And so we've had examples. I think we've seen pockets of this truly happen before. But it takes an enormous amount of trust to take that step to sanctification. And if we are not ready for that, the Lord will accept our justified efforts. That is acceptable. But the invitation is always there to take that next step. And sometimes we're not ready for it, and that's okay. But I think that we do need to recognize that there is another step there.
There is a higher way. Should we jump back to touching on the title of liberty? I know you had some thoughts.
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, you know, we've examined many aspects of the Book of Mormon this year so far in the context of covenant making. We've talked about Jacob and Mosiah and Alma, the various ways that we can read some of their sermons as, you know, evidence of covenant making, whether that's tied to Hebrew ceremonies, right, Israelite holy days, or potentially even like temple connections. And I'm struck by this instance, right? Like this is such an iconic scene in the Book of Mormon that we have Captain Moroni fastening, you know, these things. He rents his coat. It's this very, you know, he's enacting this ceremonial act. He's embodying this thing where he dresses a particular way, removes some of the clothing. He, you know, writes this covenant. He prays to God. He mentions the fact of this name that they've been given. And then there's an associated penalty when they all trod on their clothes. And when they specifically talk about the name of Christ, there's all these elements that I know other people have commented on this before, so it's not like this is surprising or new, but it's just one more thread that we are weaving through this idea of like covenants and temple imagery in the Book of Mormon that is just very powerful. But one thing that kind of stuck out to me too is that we have in the chapter before the title of Liberty, we have Alma blessing the land, when he blesses the earth for the righteous sake. And that sounds like very ceremonial.
Yeah.
And then we have Moroni naming the land and blessing it. Well, he doesn't quite name, maybe he doesn't bless the land. Maybe I misread that. But he prays for the cause of the people and he names all the land, right? This Alma is blessing land. And so, you know, a name to the land kind of has that same idea of a blessing, new name.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know, there's a lot of these elements that it's hard to say, is Moroni inventing this new thing for people to latch onto, or is he hearkening back to the tradition of, say, like even Joseph in Egypt with his famous coat? We've had mentioned in the Book of Mormon before. Do they mention that again?
It is expressly okay. Mentioned. Yes.
Yes.
Behold, we are a remnant of the seed of Jacob. Yea, we are a remnant of the seed of Joseph, whose coat was rent by his brethren into many pieces.
Oh, yes. I did have a note on this. Sorry, I should have looked ahead. Because this is kind of a strange... Did this seem weird to you?
Only in that we don't have a record of this in our records of the Old Testament. So we don't... Here's another thing that is being quoted that we don't have an original source on. So I assume it came from the brass plates.
What do we not have a... Sorry, I'm guessing so, that. Which part do we not have? Verse 24, you're saying.
Yeah, chapter 46, verse 24. Yea, let us remember the words of Jacob.
Okay, because I was looking at verse 23.
Okay, yeah.
Because if you... what I was thinking about, and one of the commentaries brought this up. Sorry, gosh, I'm all over the place. Verse 23 presents something that I think is kind of weird, because when he says, let us remember to keep the commandments of God, or our garments shall be rent by our brethren, and we be cast into prison, or to be sold and slain. Okay, so Moroni is telling his people, if you don't keep God's commandments, you're going to suffer the fate of Joseph. Mm-hmm. But Joseph, quite famously, did keep the commandments, but was cast into a prison and sold.
And then the Lord used that for good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, yes, in the end it all worked out.
But I agree. It wasn't a punishment.
Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting implementation. It might show just another one of those cases of how Nephite scripture likening happens. That they're willing to take themes, even if it's not like a perfect match, and use them because it's so well known.
Yeah, rework it to their own time and place.
Exactly. Now, if you want to talk about verse 24.
So in verse 24 of chapter 46, they quote, Moroni makes as if to quote Joseph of Egypt, or the words of Jacob, before his death. For behold, he saw that a part of the remnant of the coat of Joseph was preserved and had not decayed. And he said, even as this remnant of garment of my son hath been preserved, so shall a remnant of the seed of my son be preserved by the hand of God, and be taken unto himself, while the remainder of the seed of Joseph shall perish, even as the remnant of his garment. Now behold, this giveth my soul sorrow. Nevertheless, my soul hath joy in my son, because of that part of his seed which shall be taken unto God. So that is a quotation from Jacob that... Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe is in our Old Testament.
I think you're right. And it's not the first time that we've had a quotation from the patriarch Joseph about something that wasn't in the Old Testament.
Right, right. Lehi quotes Joseph very famously. So he says remnant in verse 24 five times. So I think it's important that we emphasize that a remnant is a remaining piece of a greater whole. And the Nephites definitely see themselves, part of their narrative as a culture is that they are a branch broken off of Israel. They believe that they are inheritors of the promises of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They look to those promises as being effective for them. And this is the reason they keep their records. And Mormon says on the title page of the Book of Mormon that the covenants made to their fathers is one of the purposes of this record being kept. So it just emphasizes how important this is in their culture and how that thread, pun intended, is carrying through all of these many centuries and all the cultural changes that are probably happening, and that remains a strong part of their identity and their cultural touchstone.
I'm glad I made you talk about that.
Well, what other themes do we want to bring out in these last few chapters? Anything else you want to address?
I had one, I don't know about a theme, but I had one question that was like, when Ammon and the other sons of Mosiah go to the Lamanites, their reception ranges from lukewarm to very poor. So why is it that when we have these Nephite dissenters go over to the Lamanites, their reception is apparently universally successful?
Yeah, their message and purposes must be... different enough to have different reactions.
You did touch on that earlier when you talked about the Lamanites being able to be influenced by various people. So I think that, mm-hmm. that raises a good point, was maybe preemptively answering that question. So thank you for that. Oh, I noticed another little parallel between Amalickiah and Moroni, which is in 48 verse 1, when Amalickiah appoints men to speak to the Lamanites from their towers. Which reminded me back again of King Noah in his tower, which makes me wonder if that's like still there.
Oh, yeah. And it's in the same land. It's the land of Nephi.
Yeah.
Oh, that is strange. I never noticed that.
So, again, not themes. Like, there's so many little bits in there.
There are a lot of details. We have a lot of pages, a lot of material in these chapters.
Okay, so we get Lehi, right? Lehi is this famous general who's the son of Zoram. And then, unfortunately, I think, you know, I can't say for sure that the Zoram, who was the former captain, defected and became the leader of the Zoramites. We talked a little bit of that, but when in verse 5 it said he did appoint chief captains of the Zoramites, they being most acquainted with the strength of the Nephites, that did make me wonder if that meant that, yeah, this group was started by Zoram and maybe initially was not apostate. Maybe initially this was just a sort of military enclave, but that their military knowledge gave them some special insights. I think verse 7 of this chapter, of chapter 48, to me is, if you got to read one verse and draw like a lesson, you've got the contrast. Amalickiah obtaining power by fraud and deceit. Moroni preparing the minds of the people to be faithful to the Lord God. If you have to just be very black and white, binary, and break it down, there you go.
Yeah, yeah, that is such a good encapsulation of the contrast, the foil between those two characters. Some more evidence for our argument about why these chapters are included to show the futility of war is in Alma chapter 50, verses 20 and 21. So 20, he reiterates the promise of the Book of Mormon, inasmuch as ye shall keep the commandments of the Lord, ye shall be prospered in the land. And he says in verse 21, and we see that these promises have been verified to the people of Nephi, for it has been their quarrelings and their contentions, yea, their murderings and their plunderings, their idolatry, their whoredoms, and their abominations, which were brought among themselves, which brought upon them their wars and their destructions. And so he just kind of lays it out like, in case you weren't paying attention, the Nephites bring this upon themselves over and over and over again. So then we have the conflict between the people of Morianton and the people of Lehi. They both lay claim to one piece of land, and the contention is warm, is that they contend warmly. They use that a few in these chapters, and I just think that's such an interesting turn of phrase. But the leader of the people of Morianton is a man named Morianton, and they're planning to run off into the wilderness and kind of start their own group, to be another dissenting group from the Nephites. And they would have gotten away with it, so to speak. But it says, Morianton being a man of much passion, therefore he was angry with one of his maidservants, and he fell upon her and beat her much. And it came to pass that she fled and came over to the camp of Moroni and told Moroni all things concerning the matter, and also concerning their intentions to flee into the land northward. So Moroni didn't know about this. It's not like he got special revelation about it. This woman, who is not named, unfortunately, but Morianton's maidservant, after he beats her, she courageously runs away. So first finds that courage to get out of that situation. And then she knows where to go. She goes to the camp of Moroni, and she goes straight to him, and she tells him what's up with these people. And her actions, like, we don't even know all of the things that her actions prevented, because they were able to address that. It might have been so much worse. So I think this is another woman in Alma whose individual decisions, a lot of things hinge on those. We only get a couple of verses about her, and we never get her name and all of that, but her courageous actions definitely saved the Nephite people, I think, from even more destruction and suffering.
Yes, I think you're right. And it's interesting, this is something I noticed, because I've been trying to read ahead, because this group from Morianton, they go all the way up to Desolation, which is sort of the furthest north point. And so they're not able to get cut off until they're almost on the borders of the land of Desolation. And it strikes me that, like, Moroni kind of could let them go. But then if you continue reading in the war chapters, this whole area that they're in actually winds up being a very contested area, like strategically very important. So it seems like Moroni is doing his best to try and like keep people where they need to be, compared to the very end of Alma, where we have lots of groups go up into the north country. Everyone's leaving for the north, so he's fine with it then. That's just like one of those things that I've noticed. But this Morianton episode is one of those things that struck me, because like I read the Book of Mormon so much, and I mean, I know this story, but if you ask me, like, I'm not sure I could have told you all the stuff outside of the fact that, you know, there was a group and the guy who was leading beat his maidservant who went to Moroni and told him, I don't know that I could have given you all the context of like the conflict and them fleeing and all of that. So, and this is all also our first introduction to Teancum.
Yes. Yeah. Big player in these chapters to come. Well, we also get the mention in chapter 50 that Nifaiha, the second chief judge, died. So Nifaiha has been chief judge since Alma gave up the judgment seat in the 9th year of the reign of the judges. So from year 9 to 24, we have 15 years that Nifaiha served as chief judge. And he died in the office of chief judge. And then the voice of the people comes and asks that Pohoran, his son, fills the seat of his father. So we have a new chief judge in the land. And this is when we get a little more of the details about Amalickiah and what happened with the rest of the kingmen who were left in Zarahemla. And I kind of want to save some of this for next week because it does kind of bleed into narrative-wise, like it kind of leads into the bigger story next week.
Well, and some of these kingmen, who, by the way, just like a little note, is a couple of the commentaries thought maybe these people are original Zarahemlaites, some of these descendants of Mulek. So the fact that they never got that kingship, maybe they still sort of maintain a pseudo-royal class. Because, right. And if you look at the first guy, right, his name's Zarahemna, which is a lot like Zarahemla. So maybe. I'm not going to say that this is like a Davidic competing line among the Nephites or anything for sure, but that's an interesting theory. But yeah, I think so, except to say, like, there is a group, right, who is, when Moroni puts everyone in jail, yeah, we deal with them later.
This happens a couple of times.
Because, well, in verse 21, sorry, I want to keep most of it for next week, I guess, but when it says in verse 21, he put an end to the stubbornness and pride of the people who profess the blood of nobility. Okay, blood of nobility. That actually does make me think that maybe these are Zarahemlites who are OG. Yeah. From Mulek, because it says he puts an end to these kingmen, but in Alma 61, the kingmen gain control of Zarahemla. So
exactly.
Did he?
They continued to be a problem in Zarahemla for several years. And let's not forget that in the first year of the reign of the judges, Amlici wanted to be a king. And that's what led to the whole thing with the Amlicites. And so this strain has not gone away. And every time that they think that they've stamped it out, it rears its head again. And so they have not really been able to deal with it in an effective way. And I would argue that even Moroni does not really know what to do about this strain of people who want greater concentration of political power in the hands of a few. So it really plagues the Nephites that they can't seem to establish the system that they really want. It continues to be a far off dream to them that they keep working towards, but can't quite get there.
Well, I'm willing to talk about that more next week.
Anything else you wanted to add this week?
The only thing that really confused me, I mean, there's a bunch of little things, but the like most shocking thing that I had to like reread and search and try and figure out any of the context is when we're told that Amaron departs out of the land of Zarahemla, because what is he doing in Zarahemla? Was he just not with the Lamanites until Amalickiah dies and then he decides to leave and go join them? I like, was he one of these kingmen? Did he make a jailbreak? Was he sort of was he hiding? It's like one of those little questions. That's just like,
I'm gonna have to look at that one again.
Mormon. Next week. tell me where he was. He comes out of nowhere. So just one of those things. There's a lot. I think we can put out most till next week, but hopefully this was a good enough thematic overview of the first part of the war chapters. I mean, next week is really exciting too, though. So I'm excited for that.
Thank you for joining us this week. If you want to get involved with the Latter-day Peace Studies project, we have a Facebook page, Latter-day Nonviolence, Pacifism, and Peace Studies. We also have a website, latterdaypeacestudies.org, and you can click on Get Involved. As always, very big thank yous to our editors and for the work that they do on this podcast. If you are interested in helping, you don't have to know how to edit to help. We will provide the training on that. If you are interested in helping to edit these podcasts, we are looking for more people to help with that. So please get in touch with us. For Latter-day Peace Studies, I'm Marianne.
And I'm Dan.
We'll see you next week.